Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. How's everybody doing today? Things are great here. We are putting the finishing touches on San Francisco Jubilee and our cookbook tour. You can go to cherrybomb.com to check out the cookbook tour. We are visiting all over the country. It's really exciting putting this tour together. We'll be in Philly, we'll be in Pittsburgh, we'll be in Charleston, Boston, all over the country. I am really excited to meet everybody. I'm trying to figure out where the heck I'm staying in all cities. I will be sleeping on some friends' couches. That means you, Libby, out in Nashville. But I think I might Airbnb it. I've never done Airbnb before, so I thought this might be a really fun opportunity. So we'll see. But definitely check out the tour dates. We would love, love, love to see you. The cookbook is out 10-10, and then we hit the road. All right, this season of Radio Cherry Bomb is presented by Le Cordon Bleu. Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school, has locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from 9-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. And special thanks to our sponsor, Castor and Pollux, maker of the brand new purposeful pet food line, Pristine. A lot of Bomb Squad members are proud pet parents, me too, so you'll want to know about this grain-free line made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. Lastly, I just want to remind you that Thrive Market is offering the Bomb Squad 35% off your first purchase, plus free shipping and a 30-day membership. Head over to thrivemarket.com/cherrybomb to learn more. Today, we are joined in the studio by one of our ultimate kitchen crushes, Allison Roman. Allison has been an editor at Bon Appetit. She's a contributor to the New York Times food section, and she's the author of the upcoming cookbook, Dining In, a collection of, quotes around this, highly cookable recipes. Allison will explain to us what highly cookable means in just a minute and tell us all about her book, which will be out on October 24th. Mark your calendars. You can pre-order it too. Allison Roman, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What a thrill. What a thrill. It's so nice to see you in the studio.
It is. It's lovely to be here.
So, okay, highly cookable recipe.
Highly cookable recipe.
What does that mean?
It is a very technical term that I sort of made up when I struggled to describe the kinds of food and recipes that I was creating. And highly cookable to me means that from the shopping to the execution to, you know, the amount of equipment you're using, everything is pretty easy and attainable and easy to execute. So there's nothing overly complex about it that's going to get in your way of making this dish.
So it's very home cook friendly.
Yes, absolutely.
I still laugh. We ran a recipe once in Cherry Bomb. I swear to God, I think it was about 4 pages long. And one of the ingredients was an aquarium pump.
Ah, yes. I don't call for any of those. Not this book.
It was by Dominique Crenn, so Dominique gets a pass.
Yes, you know. She does.
But okay, good. So no aquarium pumps in your cookbook.
Yeah.
I was scrolling through your Instagram feed. I hate to admit that I'm a bit of a slacker, but that was sort of the extent of my research this morning. I'll explain why in a second. But I noticed you had a really awesome team that worked on your cookbook.
Amazing.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I'm kind of super jealous. We had an incredible team that worked on ours, but you really had like a kind of like girl crush super group.
It was basically everyone that I worked with was a dream, and everyone that I picked said yes, which was amazing. I didn't have to go to anyone and beg or go for somebody that I was less enthusiastic about. And my photographers, Michael Graydon and Nicole Harriet, are such an amazing team. And, you know, I picked them because not only are they technically apt and brilliant creatively, but they're really into collaboration and pushed me creatively. And, you know, it was almost like having a creative direction team to collaborate with. And they were really supportive of my ideas and, you know, made my dreams come true. And so it was more than a photographer. You know, you're hiring somebody that you're spending so much time with. So you also have to really like them and, you know, drink the same types of LaCroix, which we do.
That is key. I'm a huge fan of Nicole's. She has a fantastic website called Harriet Grace.
Yes.
And if you haven't looked at that ever, take a peek. But I think it's a project we wrote about it maybe in the very first issue of Cherry Bomb. Mm-hmm. It's something she does with her dad. And he does all this beautiful, all these beautiful hand-carved wooden
instruments
for your kitchen.
Expanded a lot recently. And now she does ceramics from people that she's close with and, you know, very highly curated sort of home goods. But yeah, it started as sort of this like spoon and bowl collaboration with her and her father, which she still sells those on the site as well.
And they do sell out really fast because I'm always kind of checking to see like...
They take a long time to make.
They take a long time to make. They're not inexpensive. But if you're looking for something that's sort of heirloom quality, I mean, these would make like... This isn't an ad for her site, but these would make like great wedding gifts or something. And I think everybody's really trying to think of where and how they spend their money these days. And if you're looking to spend your money with good people who make good things, check out Harriet Grace.
That.
All right. You also worked with one of my favorite people who we covered her wedding in Cherry Bomb.
Yes.
White Lightning.
Yes. She is a legend, Elizabeth. Spiridakis Olsen. She was the designer on the book. And I knew that even before I sold the book that if I ever were to do one, that I wanted her to be a part of it. We became really close when she worked at Bon Appetit and then stayed in touch after she left. And I've just always admired her sensibility. And she's got such a great eye. And she really, whatever project she tackles, she sort of doesn't overly design anything for the sake of design. I feel like she's very thoughtful. And especially for this book, because the photos are so bold and the photography is so intense and there's so many colors, there's a lot going on, that the design needed to be a little bit more minimal and pulled back. And she understood that. So instead of going totally ham on, okay, I can do whatever I want for this project, she was so thoughtful in, okay, what are the words, what are the images, and how can design really complement that and play to it and, you know, enhance it rather than mask it or try to overthrow it all. And she was so delicate with it. And the touches that she did are so subtle. And everyone that I know in my life that's a designer or works in design will notice these things that I didn't even notice, that are, you know, these kind of small touches that she did that were just really special, that someone to the untrained eye, such as myself, may not notice at first. But yeah, she did such an incredible job.
She's so talented, Elizabeth. And she has a groovy new gig.
I know.
She's creative director of Kate Spade. Is that
something like that? I don't want to misspeak, but it's something like that of like brand stuff or a branch of Kate Spade, or maybe it's all of Kate Spade.
And she, her Instagram handle is White Lightning, if you are curious why I was calling her White Lightning. And she has a really cool post right now about traveling with her young son.
Oh, I love that.
You should read it. It's for anybody out there, even if you don't have kids. I thought it was a great post, and I don't have kids.
It was just great about anxiety.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about anxiety and projecting your own anxieties onto situations and things like that.
She's very honest and real, and I love that.
She is the senior director brand creative at Kate
Spade. That was
a
word in there somewhere.
Still a big gig, so congratulations to Elizabeth. And shout out to your prop stylist, because they don't get enough love.
Never get enough love. Amy Wilson, cannot say enough things about her. She's another one of those people where, you know, you can just tell by looking at the way she dresses. And if you've ever seen her apartment, which is impeccable, but she just has incredible style and taste. And again, also sort of knows when to pull back and when to pull out the weird, wacky vase and when to put, you know, no napkins or this or that. I wanted the feel of the book to be very natural. And occasionally with prop stylists, they want to get so many props in the shot because they're excited about it, and rightfully so. But I really wanted it to feel like this could potentially be where I live or a real life situation. And, you know, like I never have, like I don't use linen napkins or I don't have a ton of fancy things or, you know, extra stuff on the table when I'm eating. So I wanted everything to feel a little more sparse than I think some prop stylists are used to, but she really embraced it. And she just, you know, with photography, in food like that, you want it to feel natural without it feeling staged. And that's really hard to achieve. But you also don't want it to feel sloppy. So you're trying to strike this balance, and she hits it every time. And she just has the most incredible stuff and eye for things.
I love that prop stylists are kind of getting their due these days.
Mm-hmm.
There's just such a boom in ceramics.
Yes.
And just beautiful plates. And more restaurants, I notice, are making their own mm-hmm. plates and cups
yeah.
and bowls. We love Elena Reagan from Elizabeth and Kitsune
oh, yeah.
in Chicago, and she does a lot of her own. Her team does a lot of the plates and whatnot that they use.
Yeah.
And I just feel like restaurants are paying a lot more attention to that stuff.
They are, and just ceramics in general. And speaking of which, there are a few artists that I featured in the book as well. Nina Lawley from Monday's Projects, who her stuff is incredible and so beautiful and well made, and I felt I could have shot the whole book on her stuff. I think you guys used a few stuff.
We did.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was plenty of overlap. I think we used all female.
Oh, that's great.
Ceramicists.
Yeah. I tried, but you know, some weren't. But and then A&K Ceramics up in Maine, who's a friend of mine. She's really talented, and her stuff, you know, if you go to a restaurant in Maine, chances are you're eating off one of her plates or bowls, but really beautiful glazes and shapes. And I don't know, I feel very fortunate to already know some of these people and then to have discovered other artists in the process.
Very cool. So tell us a few of your favorite recipes from the book.
Mm. Gosh, I should get prepared to answer this question.
Yes.
Because this is my first official book interview, really.
Ooh.
So, you know, it's less about recipes for me in the book than it is about chapters. And my favorite chapter is probably either knife and fork salads or fruit salads, which
wait, hold on. Knife and fork salads.
Uh-huh.
Got it.
Yeah.
Or
fruit salads.
Fruit salads.
Yeah.
That you can eat with your hands or a spoon or a knife and a fork.
Yeah. It's utensil is up to you for that one. But just sort of framing these dishes in a way that are a little bit more about like the style of food than the food itself. And my goal for the book was to really inspire people to take things into their own hands and not have people be so rigid and feel like they can't deviate. So within those chapters, it's sort of the ethos of what that means to be a fruit salad or a salad that you eat with your knife and fork. But in those, there's one that's a kale salad, which I know, kale salad. I was like, am I really going to put a kale salad in this
book? I did
book?
Not roll my eyes.
I know, I love
a kale. You
did.
You rolled your eyes, but I didn't. I do love a kale salad.
But it's so good. And I actually eat a lot of kale. And I had to take a long, hard look at myself. And I really wanted these recipes in the book to reflect how I actually eat and cook. And I eat a lot of kale and in salad form. And I'm not going to lie about it. And just for the sake of it being not cool anymore. But there's a kale salad.
So yeah, what makes it special? Tell us.
It's a raw and roasted kale salad. So there's some crispy elements, and the kale that's raw gets sort of massaged. So it's really tender, but there's a ton of pecorino cheese and pistachios and a little chili. And it's so delicious to
Yum.
Eat. I think it's like a mix of those textures, but mm-hmm. one of those that could definitely be a meal on its own. And then in the fruit salad section, there's a salad with persimmons and blue cheese and pecans that is we actually played around with that dish for the cover because it's probably everybody's favorite image in the whole book. But it's kind of weird because, you know, persimmon, blue cheese are not common ingredients to a lot of people. So it was sort of like, well, are people going to know what this is?
That
it's
fruit,
beautiful. But
fruit cheese nut combo is fantastic.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started dating my boyfriend, he made peach aged Gouda and toasted pecans.
Yeah.
And he made a salad out of that. And I just thought it was the best thing I'd ever had.
You really can't go wrong. So that sort of exploits that trio of success in that chapter.
Do you toast the nuts?
Always. Always toast your nuts. Actually, funny you ask. I actually have a whole essay on why you should toast your nuts. Because, you know, I want...
That's nerdy, Allison.
Yeah, it is.
I just
is.
Have to say that.
It
a whole
truly
essay?
Is. Well, it's not like 1,000 words.
Okay.
But it's one of those things where I really want to drive home the point that I will never ask you to do something unless I can really justify it. And sometimes I read recipes and I'm like, do I really have to do that? Can I get around it? Is there a way to do that in another step combined? Like, how can I cut a corner here? And toasting your nuts is just never a corner you can cut. I firmly believe that.
I don't know why I always get nervous when I toast nuts because I feel like it's like a 10-second difference between perfection and disaster.
You will burn nuts. I do it almost every time.
Especially pine nuts. They're so easy to burn.
The smell of burned pine nuts is a strong smell from my childhood because my mom would put them in every salad and she would do them in the toaster oven. And my mom likes things extremely well toasted and very crispy. You know, we go to a diner and she's like, can I get that bacon extra crispy? And it comes and it's not crispy enough. And anyway, I sort of inherited that from her, but she would burn pine nuts almost weekly. So the smell is actually that, and the burned artichoke water from steaming artichokes are things that I grew up Ooh. With that I've start that I really, they're kind of pleasant for me.
Okay. But. So that is a great segue into tell us about your childhood, Allison Roman.
Oh my God. Well, how much time do we have? Yeah. I mean, in terms of, we'll focus the conversation on cooking in childhood maybe, but, both my parents cooked growing up. I grew up in California, in Southern California. So I should preface that with, you know, that meant a lot of asparagus and salmon and rice pilaf, which was just how we ate. It, you know, it didn't seem exotic or healthy. It was just kind of the California way when you grow up in the valley, I guess. Which, yes,
oh, you're
I am
a valley
from the
girl?
I am. Sometimes people will call me out for being a valley or sounding like a valley girl, and I say I am. So, you know, I guess.
Own it. I had that record, the Moon Unit Zappa Valley Girl, oh, 45.
Yeah. There's the movie. There's a lot of references. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there was a lot of always, there was always cooking going on. And my grandfather, he was in everyone in my family, and he died when I was about 13, I think. But he was the one, he lived in Oklahoma and grew his own tomatoes, raised his own rabbits to eat, baked his own bread, was very just into the whole aspect of food as a way of life. And he, you know, if he were alive today, he would not give a shit about this book. Sorry. I don't know if I can say that word on the radio.
It's okay.
But
I would imagine he'd be excited.
Well,
about
he would,
the path
he would, but I, if I hadn't
took.
Written it, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like it's sort of just not interesting to him to think of food as being cool because it's just what you do. Well, if you want bread, you got to bake it. If you want a rabbit, well, you got to raise them. You know, it's sort of this attitude of what's all the fuss.
It's a mindset that I think we should go back to.
Yes.
You know, I was in California a few weeks ago in San Francisco and Los Angeles. You know, and you see all the fruit trees out there mm-hmm. and you're just like, why aren't there fruit trees everywhere? The fact that anybody's hungry when half these trees we have could just be fruit trees instead. Mm-hmm. It's a weird mentality
yeah.
that we have that you can grow fruit, but anywhere
yeah,
or any kind of food anywhere, but yeah. we just don't.
There's on the side of my building, which is not, it doesn't have any vegetation on it because they like actively pull out any sign of life from the area. But the guy who takes care of our building noticed that there were pumpkins growing, and he thinks it's because the woman that lives above that particular area eats pumpkins or whatever compost
out,
and just
she probably spits pumpkin
spits
seeds out the
seeds
window.
Out. Yeah, and so they've started growing.
Just that's amazing.
With zero help in a very you know kind of rough block in Brooklyn, but that's the thing is food
nature
can grow.
God
yeah.
bless. That's why I love that gleaning movement. You know, the people who are going around and collecting fruit from trees that otherwise just get
that.
Neglected. We did a story about it in our California issue. Oh, I didn't
cool.
know about it either, but
yeah.
it's this whole movement of people who they map where different fruit trees are because some places are fruit trees and the fruit just falls to the ground and rots.
Right.
So these people go and they pick it and collect it take it to soup kitchens and food pantries instead of just letting
That's
it go
amazing.
To waste. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
So anyway, long, you know, back to you. So Southern California, what was the first thing you cooked?
The first thing I cooked, I'm not sure. My mom entertained a lot. And so I would be like her little sous chef in the kitchen. And probably the first thing I remember doing is either removing the stem from a button mushroom so she could stuff them with sausage and bake them, or trimming the leaves from an artichoke. And then from there, it was sort of like, okay, you can chop the tomatoes for the bruschetta. You can toast the, you know, slice the baguette. Or, you know, she would give me these tasks. And eventually, at a certain age, it was sort of like I had a full prep list rocking.
Okay, so I fully understand now how you got on the career path that you
yeah,
did. I don't think I had an artichoke until I was, I don't know, my 30s,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah. It's not a popular food for most people. I think it really is a California thing. And I don't even know where my mom got into them, but we had them at least once a week.
But even just the toasting of the pine nuts and the...
Yeah, she was really good. She still is. She's a great cook. And so she sort of... There was always something happening. And it really... I liked the act of doing something. You know, I didn't like feeling like there was all this activity going on or if she was having this party or doing something or... I wasn't participating. I really liked having a hand in it. And, you know, I was probably a little precocious. And I was like, I did the button mushrooms or something, you know, like very something to be proud of. And, you know, I was only the only kid at all these parties that she had.
Do you have siblings?
I do. Well, my parents are divorced. So my dad remarried and had two kids. And then my mom never had any other kids. So at my mom's parties, it was sort of, I was the only kid. And then at my dad's house, I was the older sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We are going to take a quick break, and then we will be right back with more from Allison Roman.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donnie Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do, and as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
It's time for our Thrive Market Minute. If you are a regular listener of the show, you've probably heard our newest partner, Thrive Market, is offering all of you 35% off and free shipping on your first order, plus a free 30-day trial membership. Today, we wanted to tell you about one of our favorite features of the online food market. Whether you are gluten-free, vegan, keeping kosher, or a new mom, Thrive Market makes it easy to shop by the values that are important to you. What do we mean by values? Head over to thrivemarket.com/cherrybomb to shop along with us. At the top of the page, Thrive Market gives members the option to browse the health and ingredients section, for example, which includes categories such as nut-free, high in protein, or probiotic. There's also environmental and social, which allows you to buy from certified B Corp brands, family and women-owned businesses, and local producers in the USA. No matter what is important to you and your family, Thrive Market guarantees the highest quality organic products you love, minus the retail market. Be sure to check out their Thrive Market brand with your 35% discount, and check out thrivemarket.com/cherrybomb, and you'll also receive free shipping plus a free 30-day trial membership. We are back with Allison Roman, author of the upcoming cookbook called Dining In. And Allison was telling us about her childhood and helping her mom in the kitchen, which is really cute. When did you know you wanted a career in food?
A career is an interesting word because I didn't really think of it as a career. I thought of it as a job for a long time. And I left college to cook full time. And my parents were devastated.
Oh, wow. Where'd you go to college?
I was going to school in Santa Cruz and then Santa Monica, then Santa Cruz. And then moved back to L.A. to cook at a restaurant. And I was flirting with the idea of going to culinary school, but it seemed like not the right move for me because I wasn't sure that it was what I wanted to invest in. I started as a pastry chef with the guy that gave me a job that was like, you can cut marshmallows in the back room for $8 an hour. I'll take it.
Where was that?
It was a restaurant called Sona, which was in L.A., which has since closed. They owned a bakery called Boule, which is sort of where I started. And then I moved across the street to the restaurant. And it was an amazing restaurant. And it really dates me because it was around it opened probably 15 years ago, 16, longer because, yeah, wow. But it was one of those LA restaurants that, you know, was a sort of tasting menu ahead of its time, I feel like. And they did really well, and everyone loved it. And I was by far the youngest person there. And it was really intimidating, but also really exciting. And I had a really great mentor there named Ron Mendoza. And he sort of taught me everything I knew. And he sort of took me under his wing and led me to believe that making pastries was just the same as making savory food. And you still, there's an element to cooking to it, and you still have to season, and you still have to taste, and you still have to adapt and change and kind of react to the ingredients in the same way you would savory food. So from the beginning of my career, I guess now you could call it a career, it sort of instilled in me that no matter what it is that you're making, it has to have that same approach. And so often people would say, oh, I'd love to cook, but I hate to bake because I'm not sciencey, or I'm not this. And I'm probably the least sciencey person anyone has ever met. And yet I was a pastry chef for 6.5 years.
That would be me, actually. So you would be the second least sciencey person.
Yeah.
But you loved the restaurant kitchen vibe.
So yeah, I loved it. And from there, again, like I didn't really think of it as a career. I wasn't really thinking anything. I was just living paycheck to paycheck and into the job and working 12 or 13 hours a day and reading cookbooks like crazy and eating at restaurants that I couldn't afford and just kind of trying to learn as much as possible and absorb everything and take it in. And this was before that type of culture was as pervasive as it is now. So it was a really different world. And if you told someone I was a pastry cook or a pastry chef, they'd be kind of thought it was sad or something, like, oh, I couldn't get like a real job, or I was a dropout, or I don't know. It had this stigma attached to it that it definitely does not have
now,
people leave being lawyers to be a pastry chef.
Right. Which, now pastry chefs are, I hate that whole chefs are rock stars, but pastry chefs are a big deal now. You look at someone like Liz Pruitt.
Oh God, she's amazing.
Dory Greenspan, who we all love to death. Exactly. So I met you first through Bon Appetit.
Yes.
And then I was watching, I don't know what the heck I was watching, but it was some Christina Tosi video.
Oh.
And there you were standing next to her helping out. And I think you were a brunette.
I was a brunette.
But you looked super milk bar. You had like a bandana.
Scarf.
Exactly. And you were helping out. And I was like, oh, wait a second. That's Alison Roman. She. I didn't know you had this whole past life until I saw that video.
So from LA, I moved to San Francisco. I was a pastry chef there. And then one day decided, it's a long story, but for another episode, but basically decided I would move to New York for 3 months. And during that 3 months, I was going to work at this new place called Milk Bar. They had just opened. It was a bakery. I had been working in fine dining restaurants, and I was like, I really need this break. I just want to bake cookies. Like, give me a pie to fill, a cake to frost. You know, I can't deal with any more restaurant stuff right now. Give me bakery hours. Give me all that. So I moved to New York for 3 months, sublet my apartment in San Francisco. And within the first month of being at Milk Bar, which I sort of was hooked up through a mutual friend of ours, they had worked together in New York, Christina and this guy, Evan. And so I got the job. Within a month, they're like, do you want to be a sous chef? Do you want to be a manager? And I was like, oh, sure. You know, thinking, oh, I'll figure it out later. Like maybe I'll stay 6 months or a year. You know, I'll figure it out. I'll extend the sublet. I'll just work through it. And that just turned into me staying forever, because that was 8.5 years ago, almost 9 years ago. And I never went back to San Francisco. So it was supposed to be this very short, brief stint. And I ended up staying at Milk Bar for about 1.5 years. And then got into editorial from there, which is a weird leap.
Tell us about a little bit more about Milk Bar. What did you learn working with Christina Tosi?
It was a really interesting time in Milk Bar history, I think, for them, because when I was there, they were still at Sambar, where Sambar, you know, next door where Booker and Dax was, in that space. And, you know, even I think they were open for maybe a year, if that. And they were already bursting at the seams. You know, we were sharing a kitchen with Sambar. We were sharing, you know, refrigerator space and Cambros and, you know, fermenting kimchi in one and making soft serve in the other. It was expanding, you know, and Christina knew that she wanted to grow it beyond that space. And I was like, this is so charming and cool. And you just pull a cookie out of the oven and the customer takes it. And what a nice little bakery. And she's like, that's nice, but that's not how you grow a business.
She was already thinking how to scale this
28
thing.
Steps ahead. Yeah.
Wow. So, and I should interject, Christina Tosi, who I'm sure almost all of you know, but she's the founder of Milk Bar.
Yeah. And so it was during that time that she was, you know, creating a lot of the signature items that are still on the menu today and kind of building her career from from that level and then focused on expansion. And so we moved to a kitchen in Harlem while the kitchen in Williamsburg was being built, and then moved into Williamsburg and then sort of built out that space and painted walls and put up walls and tore down walls. And it was, you know, she is one of the hardest working people I've ever worked with. And something that I really always admired about her was that it's like when you know something's not right and you need to fix it because no one else is going to fix it for you. And being like not being okay with just okay. And not being okay with knowing something's not the best that you can do and going home. Like, you don't go home, you do it again. Or, you know, you don't go home, you do go home and you take it with you. Or something, you know, mm-hmm. just knowing that you know when it's not the best.
Yeah.
And not being able to live with that, you know, and having that sort of thing nag at you and be like, could I have worked harder? Could I have done that better? Could that have tasted better? Could that have gone smoother? And really analyzing things and kind of trying to be the most efficient and always doing it yourself. She was like, we don't need help from anybody. And we worked, you know, the team of women she assembled, you know, during that time, especially, we were all really close. And everyone was just so fiercely dedicated and we worked so crazy hard. And afterwards we all still wanted to hang out with each other.
Aww. So not being okay with just okay.
Yeah.
I like that. That's going to be my takeaway from today's show. So then you, had you moved to food media from that?
Well, I moved to New York knowing that I wanted to get out of restaurants, and that was sort of the move going to the bakery, but I didn't really know what to expect at Milk Bar. So in my head, before I started there, I was going to treat it as sort of this day job while I then focused on things like trying to write or food style. Or there was this whole world out there that I had no idea existed. And it wasn't, like you said, you know, prop stylists are getting their dues now. I didn't know what a prop stylist was. I didn't know what a food stylist was. And through the process of Christina writing her first book, her first Milk Bar book, we sort of saw what it was to develop recipes and photograph them and that whole process. And it was during that time where I thought, oh, that's what I want to be doing. Like, this is great, but I don't want to own my own bakery. I'm not trying to be in charge of this one. That's what I want to do. You know, how can you still create food and have it be lasting and impact people's lives and not do it in a restaurant, you know? So doing it that way, where I was like, oh, I can write them down and people can read them. That's a way to do it. So I, from that moment, kind of started putting in efforts to just talk to everybody I knew and met in New York in that year and a half and said, you know, I'm looking to do more writing, which is what I went to school for and what I always thought I would do would be a writer. And, you know, saying I'll do anything and I'll do it for free, basically. And I did. I did a lot of stuff for free. I still do sometimes, but just ask. No, I'm kidding. Please don't ask me to do anything for free.
Let's talk after the show.
Yeah.
I have a long list of things.
Yeah. But yeah, so just saying yes to literally everything and then figuring out what I liked and what I didn't like and what my strengths were and what my weaknesses were. And inevitably, I met through Helen Holliman, who is the editor-in-chief of Munchies. She introduced me to Hunter Lewis, who was at the time the food editor at Bon Appetit. And you know,
Hunter is now the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine.
Yes, correct. And he brought me in for an interview just to be a recipe tester. This was about 6 months after Adam Rappaport had taken over Bon Appetit and done the whole redesign. They were sort of reinventing themselves as a brand. And he let me come on staff I wasn't on staff. I was a freelancer and I was in for 3 or 4 days a week and it was very touch and go. I had no schedule. I basically cleared it so that if they called me and said, can you come in tomorrow? I could say yes, because I knew that that's where I wanted to be. And I was just testing recipes and they would hand me a piece of paper and I would, you know, do the best job. And they were like, oh, okay. I guess you get this. You know how to cook, you know, you understand how to translate a chef's recipe to a home cook. You understand when things are wrong. Cause I just had a base understanding of cooking at that point.
And that was an exciting time because Adam Rappaport came in as editor-in-chief Bon Appetit and really just changed everything.
Yeah, everything.
I mean, just swept sort of everything out the door and kind of all food magazines after that just looked old-fashioned.
Yes.
And still do.
Yeah. They really sort of modernized what it means to be, they brought like home cooking to be sexy again, mm-hmm. because gourmet was sort of this already appealing brand of travel and sort of luxury and aspirational and, you know, very, you know, wonderful writing. Like they just sort of did this all pie in the sky type of magazine. And Bon Appetit had been sort of its homely, like stepsister where it's like a just like home cooking, like, isn't as cool or sexy, you know? And Bon Appetit sort of said, well, what if it was actually sexier? What if it was cooler? What if it was more interesting and, you know, more useful? And I think that that sort of set in motion what we have today, which is this sort of pendulum switch, swing of people being, of course, always interested in chefs because watching somebody that's great at their job is always fascinating. But, you know, home cooking mm-hmm. and how that can be cool and more relevant to somebody who's actually home cooking.
So let's go back to your cookbook
yes.
because we only have a few minutes. Dining In. So what are some tips? I find when you read a book like a cookbook, a lot of stuff just keeps bubbling up to the surface that's mm-hmm. very reflective of the author.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, it's very clear she's super into blank. Mm-hmm. So what are some takeaways do you think people will learn about you from the book?
That I love salt because I tell you to season all the time. My editor, Doris Cooper, would query certain stages. She's like, well, you just had me season here. I was like, well, you need to season every time you had something. And that to me is really important. But that I really love, like in the beginning of the book, there's these pantry items. And I think that that really sets the tone of the kinds of flavors you're going to see in the book and things that I use a lot of and unapologetically. So I don't want to just use anchovies once because, you know, it's the anchovy recipe. Like, I believe in anchovies and lots of stuff. And so that is a through line. And working in magazines, you sort of are conditioned to taper the amount of times you use an ingredient, which you're still mindful of in a cookbook, of course, but because it's you and should be reflective of how you cook. Like, I use preserved lemons more than once, and I use chili flake a lot and Aleppo pepper and flaky salt on almost everything. And, you know, these ingredients that sort of inform how I cook, no matter what I'm cooking, what type of year it is, you know, what for what meal, it doesn't matter. I'm probably always going to use olive oil, garlic, chili flake, lemon, you know, in some capacity, lots of herbs. It's just they happen to be how I like to eat no matter what.
How about any tools?
Tools, I'm pretty minimalist. I'm a skillet and wooden spoon and tongs kind of gal. And, you know, people always ask me what piece of equipment I couldn't live without. And I would, you know, say, like, I guess my stove. Like, I don't know. Like, there's nothing. I just got a food processor maybe 8 months ago. And it was only so I could make breadcrumbs. Literally. That's the only time I use it. I don't see the need, you know, if I'm baking bread, which happens maybe twice a year, I'll use my KitchenAid or something like that for a cake. But everyday cooking, I have a cast iron skillet or a stainless steel skillet. I have a wooden spoon. I have tongs, you know, occasionally a spatula if I really need it, but I just prefer a wooden spoon. And, you know, it's not to make any sort of statement. It's just practical. And I think that you don't need a kitchen full of crazy stuff to create a really great meal. I just went camping last weekend for the first time. It was glamping, to be honest. But, and I brought up one small cast iron skillet and a wooden spoon, and we made amazing meals, like for every meal. It was awesome. And I really enjoyed the challenge of being truly stripped down than just claiming to be, because in the kitchen, I actually have a lot of things that I could use. I think that you can do a lot with very little if you have a base understanding of how to cook.
Very cool. And you will get that base understanding when you get your copy of Dining In on
hopefully.
October 24th. You can pre-order the book right now on Amazon, or you can march to your favorite indie bookstore mm-hmm. and say to them, please carry Alison Roman's Dining In.
Yes.
Because I would like to buy it from you. I'm sure we're going to talk to you before the end of the year. So
yeah,
we're super excited that you have a book coming out. What's your Instagram handle?
It's at Alison E. Roman, Alison with one L.
Follow Alison. She's got lots of great food photos on her site, and you can just see what she's up to and follow her when she announces what her book tour is going to be.
Yes,
and
lots of good events coming up.
All of that. That's it for today's show. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. We'd also like to say a big thank you to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. And check out thrivemarket.com/cherrybomb to get 35% off your first purchase, plus free shipping and a 30-day membership. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. We would absolutely love that. And take care. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Bromley Newman, and I am a Cherry Bomb intern and food blogger. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is bomb? Allison Kane of Haven's Kitchen, who is making great efforts to eliminate food waste while making delicious, delicious food.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.